Blog Talk Radio.
What in the world is going on? Hello, everyone. Welcome to this version of Masonic Effects. Have we got a lot of things to talk about? It's been just an amazing week. It all is, you know. You sit down with all these experts that are helping us to analyze and all depends on what questions we're asking. And then knowing in the background, you know, get a little older, how, you know, have I been far, you know, I thought I was in earnest. I thought my life was moving forward. But then, you know, when you put it that way, I seem to be frivolous. And then when you put it that way, I seem to be, you know, getting in my own way. I seem to be sort of counterproductive. And when you put it that way, what the hell am I up to? I don't want to admit these things, you know. These are private thoughts and private conversations. But if I walk out anywhere and knowing what I know, especially because you taught me, then just the people that I'm seeing walking past, you know, although they're masked now, are still examples of still examples of probability, you know, unhappiness, the tensions, the qualities about people are known in general terms. And I think, you know, I'd like to at least start the show today with speaking in generalities, because good God, it's so much safer. Good Lord, it's so much safer. Apologize for the insult there. So, it slipped in. I'm prone to that. Just sit back, take a deep breath, and approach this part of your time with me with a sense of humor. I tend to think not knee slapping, falling over, or the inappropriate. You know, maybe it's okay. The inappropriate giggles when, you know, somebody is overwhelmed by the emotion of the situation. I get that. I don't find that, you know, not going to chastise the child for the nervousness. Although I see some ham-fisted types that do. Oh, what are you doing? What are you doing? That's not right. Yeah, I'm more inclined to criticize the families that are forcing this terrified little kid to kiss the corpse. You know, what the hell are you doing to me? You know, the terror, and then I'll pass that terror on to the offspring, of course, you know, just to make sure that little Hiram is as buggered up as I was by the whole experience. Yeah, just no one wants to explain anything to you, just wants to, you know, give me a, if you do it and you're cooperative, then it must be right. because Hello, everyone, and welcome to this version of Masonic Effects. Hello, and we have listeners sitting in from Latvia now, and I'd like to think you're a little closer, a lot closer to frontline and the most recent demonstration of, you know, craziness than most of us. But so I could say the same thing about listeners in Turkey. Thank you. You guys are, you know, what we know and what we're told is never as clear and clean as being there and making your own impressions. And nor do those impressions necessarily give us a completely clear and objective rendering, but we are adjusting, and in doing that, it's opening up questions and opening up doors in our minds to understand these folks that we've been ignoring. They've been ignoring us. We've been ignoring them for how long? They're just there. They exist. They're ancient cultures, and you know, so what? I'm over here in a different pinpoint on the map. And so whatever happens over there is like the weather. If it's raining or snowing over there, how many hours flight away, 14 hours flight away, well, what bearing does that have on me? Well, if you ask that question to meteorologists, they'll tell you the bearing. But if you ask me, as I'm getting in the car, I'm thinking, how many more days am I going to be able to turn on this gas guzzler and pollute the universe before I decide on either parking it and finding a community where I can walk to or take public transit, or just ignore it, pretend that it's not a problem. Mm. No more pretending. When I was a boy, I'd never have thought that. I know that existed. There were protesters around it. But the world was right and wrong, because the church taught me that, because the teachers taught me that, because the policeman on the corner taught me that. Right and wrong, simple. Accept it, and the world is easier. Accept both the upside and the downside, the dark side, and life was less complicated. Hmm? Along comes this, you know, crazy idea of what the hell are we doing? And, you know, how close is this to living an illusion? And yet I like the idea of the simplicity. Same thing, fast forward to what's happening around us today. And I still enjoy the simplicity, but the ideas that make it possible all the qualifiers are quite interesting. I have when I listen to people that are just embracing Eastern philosophies or philosophies in general, they are fascinating, because I don't see them. It might be sort of a loathsome kind of a personality underneath it all, but I see that energy and that earnestness, that, you know, the willingness to engage, and I like the Eastern ways, and I like the Western philosophers who are confident enough in their material, confident about not being fearful of what they don't know, or being, you know, asking the hard question. They encourage that. They encourage the difficult question, where there's that edginess. Almost, I haven't got a clue about that. But the older you get, you find it's not so easy to say that when you, in fact, you do have opinions on lots of things. And when that said, we then do, wonder about things like, you know, influences that we have on people around us, which brings me up to the topic today, the commentary today, the psych effects uptake. That was a bit of a genius segue there. I do say so myself, but the way we embrace life is you can be perfectly happy, blinkers on, materialist, you know, be perfectly happy, and then you'll, of course, there's always influences, subtle and otherwise, and we live with people that see the power in politics and the ability, seemingly, to influence large numbers of people with this underlying feeling that once that's done, we will be able to implement a better way of living, an order that's better for the average person. And it means we break life down into into values, hard work. Here, a work ethic is an advantage, and we see that in most places. Oh, well, as soon as we do that, then we have to begin to ask questions about opportunity, access, and equal access. And then we begin to look at the reasons why that doesn't happen. And so we don't live in an absolute kind of an environment. And then when we do that, as soon as we look at that, we begin to see that, my goodness, isn't that a bias? Huh? And what's the basis of the bias? Is it just limited experience and ignorance, or is it belligerence? You know, is it the color of my skin and the color of your skin? It's all, you know, or is it something tribal? It's your accent. I don't like the religion that you practice, as if, you know, who gives it? What does it matter whether I like it or not? Yeah. But if I have a little power, then I can use that. You know, I don't like you. I don't want the world to know. But when we look at in our own thinking at the record, always and everybody has things in their life that are embarrassing. I don't mean, have no intention of bringing that kind of thing up. It's really that isn't it also evident that we have that striving, always apparent, always with us, striving to do a little bit better with what we have. Even the knuckleheads, they get up trying to do the best that they can with what they have. And if that's, a snatch and grab at the local store or mugging somebody, we say, well, you don't do that because it's, you know, in order to stop you from doing it, that means we're all going to have to walk around with a big stick and be very suspicious of any kind of stranger. Well, not every culture is like that. Oh, that's very, very hard to admit this. It's not every culture. Not every culture, of course, there's imperfections, you know, that little dot in the yin-yang symbol, you know, the probability happens. But some cultures that we know about now and more teach gravitas. They teach importance, teach significance of the individual, of your thinking and your well-being. Oh, to humanize the condition. You can be, have you ever seen somebody that's just a terrible, unpleasant bully being humbled because they're so injured and somebody has offered them a kindness? Have you ever seen that? Even, you know, it's remarkably limited to the person that just can't relate to that. That's a type of pathology. We have treatments for that kind of thing. Thank goodness, you know, we've figured that out. But the vast, vast majority are simpler to understand. And that awakening, that realization that, and what that is, what the reality, that realization is, we'd have to talk about it because we'd have different ranging opinions on it, wouldn't we? That's the kind of world that we live in, that with that potential. I don't think that there's rose-colored glasses on half the planet. And I don't think that when you tell me when somebody's, you know, trying to build themselves up by explaining. I had a fellow not too long ago that was talking to me about something called a snowflake. You probably are familiar with it, and it's in part of the lingua franca of the day around here. as if there's that's all weak and soft, and there's no substance or power to it, no strength to it. I don't know where do you begin, and then it's like why to begin? That wasn't the I was having a different conversation in my mind than he was in his. He was going to impress me about his worth and his pronouncements were going to be convincing, that the moon is made of cheese and the earth is flat. You get these episodes, these events happening around you. If you look for them, they're there. But, after a while, the things you look for can begin to define you. It's not so much that we're in this blur. It's that it's not that it's overwhelming. It's it. The reality is, what this is showing us and has for a long, long time is just how complex we are. To think, oh my goodness, I don't want to think that way. I don't want to think that fast. I don't want those components. I don't want to have to do those calibrations and calculations all the time. Like, oh, that must be tiring. Where did you ever get that idea? Because in the same moment, you're the boy sitting there watching your bobber for the most subtle little motion that a fish has swum along, taking an interest in your bait and is having a nibble. And you're thinking, trout, butter, frying pan, campfire. You know, you're holding your breath. You know that your grandfather said, well, you'll catch more fish, Dale, if you're not tromping along the bank here, because the fish will hear, they'll hear the vibration, they'll hear that you're walking and it scares them off. Ah, you mean a little bit of stealth there. He didn't say that word, but yeah, I got the point is just that what you're looking for, it's life and thinking with precision. It's the surgeon's tools. What the jeweler's tools, isn't it? And then the beauty of it is, I can do that and I can master the mechanics of it. But then can I explain? That's important because in those explanations we begin to find variations and we notice things. So walk in the door of the lodge, notice things. What triggered all of this? Well, I've been reading fascinating, you can tell. What fascinates me these days, I've been just flipping through the latest, my newest copy, volume 134 of Toro Coronati's annual. And what caught my eye was this very, very, the Hiramic legend and the creation of the third degree, if not the Reverend Dr. John Theophilus de Saint-Galier, then who? This is Christopher Powell who wrote this. Fascinating. I recommend it. I recommend it to one and all. That's what triggered this kind of conversation with you today. But enough. Thank you for sitting in the Netherlands. And if any of you are fans of the World Cup, good luck to you and your nation in your various groupings. And be aware, my nation is there the second time since 1986, I think. So, of course, be afraid. Be afraid. We're coming. We're coming and we're mighty in our own minds. Anyway, I want you to sit back and enjoy the program today. Good show. And we'll try and share some attitude and atmosphere with you right here. This is we're going to begin with some Bill Evans, How Deep Is the Ocean, yeah. Beautiful, beautiful. The commentary today, uptake. Being unassuming is hard when you've become enthusiastic about finding compelling truths. But there you have it, Masonry. He will get a telling response whenever he is noticed, obviously. But being friend to all, having some semblance of social conscience, comfortably learned, doesn't preclude the enthusiasm of a scholar who's joyfully overwhelmed by the depth of learning in his field. A spillover from other fields. Celebration that dissolves into silence that isn't awkward. Just a change in what's being communicated. I want to tell the world. The talents needed to audition for a position in the craft is harder today than it once was, I think. But that is elitism, you know, wallowing in indulgence. If we aren't aware, we aren't going to benefit from insight. If we don't value character, then that is what and who we are. No moral dilemma. It's enough to make a man wonder if Freemasonry is an ancient word that means smart or education or learning. Or, hey, pay attention. Bring your school colors and team songs as you like. Wear the jacket, but there will be a day when the bunting is less important than the product. It's being taught to think, being socialized into a different life than what you once had, seeing more clearly. Hiram must have been a Zen master, you know, when you think about it. My goodness. His koans all put us to the tasks at hand. We learn as we work. I mean, after all, the legend is that happening on a work site, yeah, and it was building something noble, yeah, okay. But we learn, and we learn that life has detail that matters when we make it matter to your scheme, when they make it matter to your scheme. Nice to be recognized, but, gee, that isn't the goal. Father Hines, Earl Hines. Not bad. Not bad. Hope you haven't been completely overwhelmed with the delicacy of the commentary today. But you might be with the poetry that I've selected. You know, it takes a while to go, you know, you look at it and it's a joy. What kind of poetry would listeners, you know, just in general, you know, I try to keep it, I don't even know if I'd say mixed, and, you know, in a variety, because, you know, I'm prone to all that period of the thinking that came out of the Enlightenment. What was going on in the inner mind, the inner man, and comment about nature began to surface. And still, even after I say that, I shake my head. It's like thinking about days when written language was just being gradually introduced. And when before there was agreement about spelling and pronunciation and such. The poet today, though, is one that I've overlooked for a while. I don't think I've ever, in all of, you know, the 11 years of the program, I've ever looked at this. Although I've read it, I think it's lovely, and there's movies about it. Walt Whitman. He's a guy born in 1819 in Long Island, New York. Yep. Before the Civil Wars and after Civil Wars, this is a landmark. And he was born. Yeah, it was late. It was after, wasn't it? He was born into a family that settled in North America in the first half of the 17th century. His mom is Dutch, and his dad, Walter Whitman, was English, or I said English descent. And they were like my family. They were farm people with little formal education. And I'm glad underline formal, because if you've ever been living or worked with a farmer, the amount of information is exceptional. The Whitman family had once owned a large tract of land, but it was so diminished by the time Walt was born that his father had taken up carpentering. And the family still lived on a small section of the farm, or, you know, here we're talking about the estate, because this guy has become famous. So the dad moved his family to Brooklyn, which was in a boom back in the day. And he was speculating in real estate and building cheap houses for people. But he wasn't very good at managing the money. And birth control being what it is, you know, trying to feed 9 children. So he sent little Walt, his second boy, to public school in Brooklyn. Like a lot of kids, at age 12, he went out to work and began the printing trade, which is reminds me of a lovely fellow that had a similar path in a way from Glasgow. And he was employed as a printer in Brooklyn and New York. And at the age of 23, he edited a daily newspaper. Pretty good, you know, smart little. 1846, he was the editor of the Brooklyn Daily Eagle. And it was, we had a good readership. It was significant, had things to say about what was going on at the time. And he was discharged, fired from it because of his support of the anti-slavery Free Soil faction of the Democratic Party. Fired. And he went to New Orleans, Louisiana, where he worked for 3 months on the Crescent, the paper there, before he went back to New York. I traveled up the Mississippi River and the Great Lakes. And he tried again at Free Soil journalism, and he built houses and dabbled in real estate until 1855. He spent a lot of his 36 years walking and observing New York City and Long Island. And he visited theater and saw many plays by Shakespeare. you developed a very strong love of music, especially opera. God love them, eh? During these years, he also read extensively at home, and he began experimenting with a new style of poetry. Yeah, which is the advantage of all of us, to the grace of all of us. And so in the spring, he had enough poems in this new style for a volume. So he couldn't find a publisher, so he sold a house that he owned and printed the first one himself, first edition. And no publisher's name, no author's name. But the cover was a portrait of Whitman, broad-shouldered, you know, Bacchus-browed, you know. And though appreciated little upon its appearance, this first book, Leaves of Grass, was warmly praised by the poet and essayist, none other than Ralph Waldo Emerson. Yeah, that one, who wrote to Whitman and said that it was the most extraordinary piece of wit and wisdom America has yet contributed. So after the outbreak of the war, Whitman's brother was wounded at Fredericksburg, and Whitman went there in 62 and staying some time in the camp and making a temporary post in the postmaster's office. He spent his spare time visiting wounded and dying, and he was trying to cheer people up and trying to alleviate some of the depression and suffering that was going on. Anyway, there's more about this interesting guy, but the poem here is it's one that he wrote shortly after the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. And it was an extended metaphor to memorialize Lincoln's life and work. And the captain, it's called The Captain, Oh Captain, My Captain, and presented the captain represents the assassinated president. The ship represents the war-weathered nation following the Civil War. And the prize won represents the salvaged Union. But the speaker, the one that's telling us the story, is torn between relief and despair, almost as if they could see our contemporary situation with watching the United States come closer and closer to a return to civil war. There's confusion. At the end, it said that Whitman noticed and saw America's confusion at the end of the Civil War. And you can only imagine how much controversy there is about this. Speaker believes he should be part of the other group celebrating the return to safety, but he isn't. So see if you find these themes. Oh, Captain, my Captain, our fearful trip is done. The ship has weathered every rack. The prize we sought is won. The port is near. The bells I hear. The people all exulting while follow eyes the steady keel, the vessel grim and daring. But oh, heart, heart, heart. Oh, the bleeding drops of red where on the deck of my captain lies. Fallen cold and dead. Oh, captain, my captain, rise up and hear the bells. Rise up, for you the flag is flung, and for you the bugle thrills, for you bouquets and ribbon wreaths, for you the shores are crowding. For you they call, the swaying mass, their eager faces turning. Here, captain, dear father, this arm beneath your head, and is some dream that on the deck you've fallen cold and dead. My captain does not answer. His lips are pale and still. My father does not feel my arm, and he has no pulse or will. The ship is anchored safe and sound, its voyage closed and done. From fearful trip, the victor ship comes in with object won. Exult, O shores, and ring, O bells, but I with mournful tread walk the deck my captain lies, fallen cold and dead. Little something from Spain. Chamorro, Spain, puts together these bands of music students that are just, yeah, lovely. Just lovely. As if these are things that I'm going to talk to you about that, you know, we sort of rounds out and fills in some of the assumptions that are made. We've been talking about influences, and I think, you know, we have this written down, this material written down and passed on to us from the 17th and 18th century, only that it matters if it has any influence or bearing on our thinking. and it does when we hear people making certain assertions. This is the date. It's confirmed, and that's the way it was. And then historians sort of say, really? Hmm. Well, the historians went at this one, this whole period of our history, our common history. I've talked in different times about, you know, Anderson's Constitution, 1723, and then what, 12 years later, was it? 36 or so, 14 years later. Anyway, this casts a whole different light on it because it's alleging one very rare version of the Masonic Constitutions printed by a London Whig publisher stated in passing that the orders and constitution had been agreed upon in 1663. Still other of the earliest publications about the Freemasons, but not put out by the official Grand Lodge, claimed that no constituted lodges or quarterly communications were heard of till 1691, when lords and dukes, lawyers and shopkeepers and other inferior tradesmen, porters not accepted, were admitted into this mystery. And there is other evidence in English as opposed to Scottish activity, and that's be careful about that. It is distinct. Scottish Masonry developed on its own path. Activity, there was no evidence for English activity earlier than 1717, including the involvement of the architect and fellow of the Royal Society, Christopher Wren. Here's an error. Here's how we should be a lesson that might make us a bit more cautious. In 1774, the historian de Vignol informed a rebellious lodge in Berlin about the early history of the London Grand Lodge. And he said it like this: Sir Christopher Wren, famous architect, keeper of the king's fortresses, member of parliament, had been elected in 1710 for the second time Grand Master of the Society. He held the chair until 1716, and at that time the brothers realized that at the age of 88, in fact, Wren was born in 1632, so he would have been 84, but who's counting, he was not able to oversee their conduct. He was too old, and they resolved to unify themselves and to give him a successor. One only found four regular lodges in London. They assembled and represented Brother Wren by the master of the oldest lodge. But if this historian gave an accurate account, and he is quite self-conscious of the letter about saying that the information extends Anderson's history, then we can push the establishment of the English Grand Lodge, London Grand Lodge, back to at least 1710, if not earlier. Decades before de Vignol wrote to Berlin, the deputy Grand Master in London wrote about almost casually in 1757 to a Dutch officer and mentioned Wren as the predecessor of the first Grand Master listed in Anderson's official history. Thus, it would seem we can date the beginning of organized English Freemasonry to sometime during the reign of Anne, when she died in 1714. That may be mildly interesting to lovers of dates, but there is more at stake here than the date. Knowing the dates and the people involved helps us uncover an aspect of early Enlightenment culture, both in Britain and on the continent. We should focus on a moment on the relationship between the beliefs and practices of a radical free thinker named Tolan and the beliefs and practices that could be expressed in the new sociability. Tolan searched all his life for an alternative to the Christianity of his day. He also possessed an interest in rituals of all kinds. In 1711, he claimed to a continental correspondent in The Hague that he himself was devising a new ritual. It would now appear that his interest extended to the new Masonic lodges. Tolan was an inventor of ritual for which he was called the Socratic Brotherhood. He called his Socratic Brotherhood. These were what he sent to The Hague, if not elsewhere. He was a known visitor to the Dutch Republic, and even before he being translated into French, his deistic writings were available in Dutch in early 1710. He also knew and spoke French. We know that in London, Tolan associated with the Whig politician Sir Robert Clayton, who, it is believed, had Masonic affiliations. And from him, Tolan could easily enough have learned about Masonic practices and terminology. There may have been some other sources for Tolan's fanciful excursion into the creation of fraternal rituals. In Whig circles, various private clubs with ritualistic and libertine overtones were fashionable, particularly after 1689. The Kit Kat Club called its members knights and had a president who taught what faith the priests of all religions hold. In 1711, it sponsored a very public procession through the streets of London that culminated in the burning of an effigy of the Pope. So, there's history, and then there's history. And then there's the matter of what we believe and the dates. To think it just dropped out of the clouds is fanciful. There were precursors. There was ideas that had been percolating and building and developing for a long time. Now, if you're more of the materialist, you'll say, well, none of this really matters to me in 2022. But if you're wanting to apply what can be learned from our early history, then is it possible that assumptions that we're making today are just as perhaps fanciful, although no less in earnest? And is it feasible then that in spite of these approximations, we have the advantage of being able to build an understanding of early an understanding enough to explain the influence, the uptake, what we want to pick up and take from our past that will approximate and redefine us. I would think that in the 17th, 16th, 17th, 15th, 14th, how far back do we go? That when a blacksmith picked up a hammer at his forge, that and made an implement, that he wouldn't have been shocked by a contemporary blacksmith at his forge working on whatever magic and artistry repairing equipment as we do today. We would include welders and all of that, all of the artisans and all the farmers that do their own work and scientists that are people in labs. We look at each other and we can compare. We compare our notions from early days with us today, and that's how we refine a little bit. But funny thing, I don't think that, I think there is a dichotomy here. We have the old school galleries, the old school judges that think of Paris, where, again, I'm going to drag this one out. Sorry about that. The establishment was saying, this is the art that we admire, and we judge any new art according to that standard. And lo and behold, all this gaggle of people painting in an impressionist style said, oh, no, well, look at us. It's different. It's not better or worse. It's different. And my goodness, didn't Paris agree? So anyway, I'll leave you with that comparison, that hopeful sense that we are approximations of what we were. But instead of thinking that somehow we fail, let's at least realize that we have the potential to pick up the ingredients, the propositions, the definitions, all of the work that was handed to us from the before, even when we stumble, even when we stumble, you know, even when we are learning the engineering as we go along. Still, yes, my goodness. That we pick it up, pick up the pieces, and build them better and stronger and higher than what we were given. And in the meantime, we do it with that sense of joie de vivre, that esprit de corps, the joy and the adventure of the travel, the unknown. We don't know, but it's interesting as hell. Thank you for tuning in today. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. And if this is the only place that acknowledges you, what you are and who you are and what you contribute, I admire that, the humility. I certainly do. Whether you're a lion of business or a designated captain of the ship or a humble sweep on the street. The philosophy is strong in you, and I'll acknowledge that on behalf of all the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you'll be joining us next week. It's a pleasure to have you here. A little Michelle Petrucciani, just fabulous. His death was a loss. Enjoy.
Thank you.